I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, welcome to In the Pink, the podcast with me, Natalie Pinkham. Thank you so much for all your fantastic feedback, particularly on the Claire Williams podcast, and the support for Williams has been incredible. I didn't doubt that for a minute, but it was great to hear your thoughts on their plight and everybody's support to get them back to the front of the grid where they belong. And that segues nicely to my next guest, who is Mr. Rob Smedley, formerly of Ferrari as Felipe Massa's race engineer, and of course more recently with Williams. He's a much-loved member of the F1 paddock, taking something of a sabbatical at the moment. We hear all about that. He's clever, funny, self-deprecating, and of course with a phenomenal racing passion and brain. He talks to me about family bereavement, about unfulfilled ambitions, and of course plenty of F1 chat. Now, I must just say that when we did this interview, it was nice and early at Soho House. Nobody else was there, but gradually it started to fill up. So there's a bit of background noise. Apologies for that. I do hope it doesn't distract you from what is essentially a great chat with a great man. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Rob Smedley on In the Pink. Rob, great to see you. How are you?
I'm all right.
Yeah?
I'm all right. I'm very relaxed, in fact.
Well, I was going to say, you must be, because you're not really working that much at the moment, are you?
How dare you? that is such a... No, I am, actually. I'm working...
You're considering your options.
So I'm doing consultancy.
Okay.
And I'm setting up different businesses. And I'm having the time of my life, in fact. Yeah, I am. I'm really enjoying it. I'm kind of getting a whole new view on life. The FOM thing, we can talk about that a bit more. And then consulting for other clients as well, just using my knowledge that they want to kind of tap into. And then building up these other things as well. I don't know, it's kind of like, it's a whole new world for me, but I thought I would be much keener to get back into Formula One, but with the options that I've got now, I'm less keen, if you like.
See, I didn't think you'd say that. I think Formula One can be addictive, and I think that you can say, oh, just one more season, before you know it, you look back at 20-odd years, and that doesn't necessarily mean it's very healthy for your lifestyle, particularly when you've got a young family.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you if you are missing that competitiveness, the competition of F1 that is... As I say, almost a drug.
Yeah, the things that I miss, which may take me back there, you know. I'm not saying that I'm not going to do it. I'm just saying right now I'm not. It's not top of my considerations list. But the things that would take me back there is definitely that, you know, the things that I love and I've never stopped loving is the Saturday and Sunday afternoon, and you know, for a lot of my life, the being away from my family, being basically married to a job, the horrendous amount of travel and staying in rubbish hotels and bad flights and all the rest of it, that kind of compensated for it. But it got to the last 3 years or whatever, and it didn't compensate for it anymore. You know, I still love it, you know, when I'm in that moment, and it's the Saturday or the Sunday afternoon, and you're kind of pitting your wits against other people, then you know, I still get a massive buzz out of that. It's still what we do it for as engineers. You know, we want to, you know, think that we're better than another group of engineers. So we go and, you know, put ourselves against them every Saturday and Sunday afternoon. And I still love doing that. But it's you sacrifice a lot to get to that point. You sacrifice an awful lot to get to that point. And the other bit that I miss, I guess, is just working with, you know, good groups of people and working in big teams, you know, by big groups, big departments of very, very clever people, and having that whole learning by osmosis that you kind of do, you know, each minute of every day. So there's them bits that I miss, but then, you know, there's lots of new stuff that I'm learning, and just lots of opportunities that have kind of just opened up. You know, I remember saying to Lucy, my wife, when I first kind of stopped in, you know, and it was like February time, and I was lucky because I had clients straight away that wanted to come and work with me. But I also had this time on my hands where I could, like, take the kids to school, and, like, I was home at weekends and stuff like that. So I used to take the kids to school, and I'd be walking back, and all the cars in the drives that were there had now gone because people had gone to work, and, like, the streets were really, like, you know, the little roads around where we live were all really quiet because everyone had gone to work. And I had this, like, massive feeling of guilt, like, as if I was doing something wrong. But then I thought to myself, well, you're just being stupid, because if they could do it, they would be doing it. So yeah, here I am. So, yeah, at the minute, you know, there's bits that I miss, but there's also bits that I don't miss, definitely.
Well, it's quite nice just to take stock and reflect. And as you say, opportunities are bound to flood in, not least from your time in Ferrari. You know, just that association alone is enough to be compelling, which actually reminds me of my earliest personal memory of you.
Right.
Wait for it.
This can be back.
No, it's good. It was just that I remember walking into the track in Monza and just seeing this sea of red, this kind of crazy Tifosi going nuts. And I was like, who are they going nuts for? And it was you. And I remember thinking, wow, this lad from Middlesbrough is here and sort of deified by the Italian public. And that must have been, well, it was surreal enough for me watching, but how on earth did that feel for you?
Well, weird when it all started, to be honest. You know, you got a bit used to it, but quite weird. I'm still a little bit taken aback by it, how people would be interested in like an engineer kind of thing. I'm still very taken aback by it. And in fact, the Italian, like the Ferrari fans, even though I left and went to Williams, they're still really good. You know, it's still difficult for me to get in and out of Monza. And it's just a nice country, you know. It's a country that will remain part of me now. You know, I'm an adult. Well, I try to be an adult. I've kind of grown up. But that was part of, I think men grow up at different stages, don't they? You know, and I think I didn't fully grow up until I was about 40, so about 5 years ago. So that was definitely part of my growing up phase of kind of living with that and living in that country and dealing with it and dealing with kind of being this for want of a better word, which makes me sound a bit weird, but a celebrity or a Formula One celebrity, if you like, which is not a real celebrity, by the way. I just kind of loved it, and it's part of me. You know, we have so many friends there. We were back there in February as well, in our old house, which is actually the house where Jean Todt used to live.
Be posh then.
No, it's not very posh at all. Well, our friends live there now, and we used to be next door neighbours, so we used to live across the field kind of thing from them. And it was just nice to be back. You know, we just got so many friends and the, you know, so many good memories, and it was nice to just walk around and see people. And I don't know, it'll always remain part of me. It's kind of defined me in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I want to go even further back and look at your childhood and coming up through the ranks. Now, I was talking to Ted Kravitz about you the other day, and it made me laugh because I said, and I don't know where I got this from, maybe you told me this and duped me, but I said, well, he went to Cambridge, didn't he? And Ted went, no, he's not that clever. I mean, he's smart, but he's not that smart. You didn't, you went to Loughborough. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you must have been sporty as well as clever. What was your sport?
Football. Always football, really.
So you must have been pretty handy at it to go to Loughborough, because all my mates that went to Loughborough were good at sport and wanted to get a decent degree as well.
No, not really. I think Loughborough, it's a bit of a misnomer, really. Loughborough is a really, really good engineering degree. It's a fantastic engineering degree. And the reason why I picked Loughborough was because it's got a little bit of something to do with sport. But it's more to do with the fact that someone's moving chairs about.
Yeah. Good. Apologies to our listeners for this dragging of furniture across the room. Pick it up. I'll send Smedley in.
Has it stopped?
Yeah.
So I went to Loughborough just because it was a great engineering degree, but it was also a little bit practical as well. I've always been quite a practical engineer. So I like to get my hands dirty, you know. I like to kind of get in there and make stuff, as well as understanding the theory. You know, I'm slightly obsessed with maths and stuff like that, which makes me an uber geek. So I think that's Ted's perception of what, you know, smart people go to Cambridge or Oxford. There's a little bit of truth in that, but I'll be slightly contentious now as an engineer. They're not the smartest people that come out of Oxford and Cambridge, you know. I've got friends. If I could have gone there, then I probably would have chosen not to go there.
Oh, okay. You went, I've got friends, What? Who went there and weren't that smart, or that didn't should have gone there?
I've got friends who went there. You know, I've got friends.
You've got friends. I'm sure you do have friends.
It was just something to drop in as part of the conversation that I've got friends, because nobody thinks I have. Really? No, I've got mates who went there, and you kind of look at them and you think, well, they didn't really come out with a very good technical degree, you know, maths degrees or engineering degrees. They do something called engineering science there, and they're all very proud of it, the people who come out. And you think, well, yeah, nice, slightly useless.
Okay, well, anyone listening from Oxford and Cambridge, please don't worry. Sorry about some matters. What about anyone who's kind of coming up through the ranks now in the education system and wants to know which direction to go in if they want to end up in F1? Is there a path, or clearly you just have to forge your own? But are there good steps, decent steps that you can take?
Yeah, of course there are. And, you know, I'm being a bit ruthless with Oxford and Cambridge, but of course, you know, I always, you know, that they would be one of my first go-to colleges, or two of my first go-to colleges, in fact, for you know, young people coming through. I think you've got to have a good degree. You've got to show that you are technically very, very bright, and that's always been the case in Formula One. Otherwise, you know, there's just no place for you. You just won't survive. But I think on top of that, you've got to be doing something a little bit different. You've got to, you know, there's this whole Formula student thing, which is good, but it's slightly prescribed, you know, it's a slightly prescribed thing of what the universities do. But that's not to belittle it, you know. I'm a great advocate of that. I'm a great supporter of it, because I think that it kind of teaches people not so much about racing cars or the technical side of it. It teaches them to work in a team, and I think that's important once you get into Formula One. You've got to have a huge amount of resilience. You know, it's like any business which has a superficial glamour to it or whatever. You've got to get in there, and you've got to be prepared to get down at the grassroots and really work your arse off. Can I say that?
Absolutely.
I've just said it. And take a lot of knocks if you're going to succeed. You know, you got to.
And did you take a lot of knocks? Because it seemed that your path was actually fairly clear. I mean, you sort of stormed through from Jordan. Just tell us about those days, Fisichella's race engineer.
Well, I did, yeah, and I did all that at a very young age.
Mm. And given that you didn't grow up till you're 40, you were really young.
Yeah, that's right. I was very, very young to be doing all of that when I started, and you know, I'm eternally grateful to Eddie Jordan, although don't tell him that. He won't listen to this, will he?
I'm eternally grateful. He's done this podcast. He listens to them. That's it. Secret's out. He loves you. You love him.
Well, he does, yeah, and he always comes and he gets very excited when he's drunk, and he says, well, he doesn't get drunk, does he? He's just hyper on life. And he always says to me, I made you. Oh, I remember once being stood in, I was in a restaurant having dinner with Sam Michael, who used to work at McLaren and Williams and all the rest of it. And we were sat having dinner, and Sam come back with the best retort ever, which was we were sat there and Eddie came over half cut again, and he said I made you too. And Sam said to him, no Eddie, we made you. And I think that was the best retort ever. So I think we probably all made each other, but it was a great time. And Eddie put a lot, he was kind of somebody who could see, I think he's like a bit of a talent spotter, because there was a lot of good people who came through Jordan and then went on to do other things, accelerated into other areas of Formula One. And we were a good team at the time, you know. We were kind of this whole, I hate the phrase actually, because it's oft misused, but punching above your weight kind of thing. But Jordan was like that. It was like the little terrier. But I don't know whether it punched above its weight or everybody else just punched below their weight. You never really know in life, do you? But definitely, let's say Jordan did as well as it could do. And it's always been a team, you know, when it's transformed into Force India and now Racing Point, you know. It's always been a team with that culture behind it, so it was good times. And yeah, I went there as a data engineer on the test team, and I think within 6 months I was a race engineer on the race team. So it all kind of accelerated quite quickly. Spent a couple of, you know, about 3-4 years there, I think, in the end.
And what sort of person were you, if you could look back and describe yourself now?
Oh, an idiot, utter idiot.
Really? In what sense?
just as a person, you know. But all young lads are now. I like quite often, like I'll be on the tube or whatever, and like just watching groups of like young men or youths, thinking idiots.
Did you clash with Fisichella? I seem to remember a story about that. Maybe you told me.
You seem to have got a lot of stuff that I've told you that I can't remember telling you.
No, this is what happens when you come out drinking after a race.
Yeah.
You glean your information. It takes 8 years, but it comes up in a podcast years later.
I can't remember clashing with Fizzy. I can remember. Well, I can remember. We would have clashed because I kind of.
That's probably a good thing.
No, yeah, exactly. It's not a. It wasn't a. It's not a bad thing, you know, in terms of clashing aggressively, if you like. I think you've got to have, you know, even when I you know, become more senior and I've had lots of, you know, more and more people working for me, I quite like that really healthy environment of having conflict in the workplace, you know, a healthy amount of conflict, not like people like dragging each other over the desk and punching each other, but having somebody who'll stand up and go, hang on a minute, is this right? Because I think if you don't have that, you're all kind of just, you know, if it's very hierarchical and, you know, if it's my department and what I say is correct, it doesn't work, and it will never work in a competitive environment like Formula One. So you've got to have that some amount of conflict, and that could be conflict, you know, down at, you know, between two individuals, and it could be conflict between, you know, one side of a department and the other side of a department. You've probably got to have somebody who arbitrates and marshals that conflict, but having a little bit of conflict is great. So I've always been one that would definitely, you know, kind of promote that and advocate it in the right way. And probably, you know, when I was a race engineer and the job was a lot smaller than a race engineer's job is now, let's say, in some ways it was at least. We had less people working for us back then. Definitely having a little bit of conflict with, you know, the data engineer or the driver himself, I think, is a good thing.
Yeah, challenging each other. I don't know how that fits into the Ferrari model. Tell me, like, is it more hierarchical, or is there the sort of checks and balances that you talk of?
No, I think that, you know, you got to imagine that. It was a place that was much more politically astute. That was the big thing for me, you know, walking out of Jordan and walking into Ferrari. All of a sudden you're in this place which is, you know, far better run. You've got much more resource to do what you want. You've got, you know, a bigger set of, you know, bigger group of people to do what you want in terms of engineering, in terms of just the infrastructure, and the culture of winning is there from the outset. But it was a more politically astute place as well. You had to kind of, you know, you couldn't go there and think that the way that you acted as a team or even as an individual in a place like Jordan or Benetton of the day, you know, places like that, would be, you know, acceptable in a place like Ferrari, because there was a hierarchy. But that hierarchy was very, very good in setting boundaries, and I think that's what they did very well. And it wasn't an overbearing hierarchy. You know, if you take the top of the tree was John Todd, who kind of looked after me from the outset of going to Ferrari, and then directly under him was Ross, and Ross worked with Paolo Martinelli on the engine side, Rory Byrne on the design side, but really Ross was the technical boss, and they just did a fantastic job of running the company, and they set the boundaries of where they wanted us to work, but they also had a very very clear vision and a very very clear plan, and that was the first time I'd actually seen that, and that I learned so much in those early formative years at Ferrari, where I could kind of watch these Formula One megas at work, really, and see how they worked together and see how they interacted. And it was only when they left as well that you understood how much they were doing. Because we were dominant in 2003, in 2004, and 6 and 7 and 8. The car was the best car ever. It was totally dominant, especially that 04 car. It was the same level of dominance as probably what Mercedes have got now. Probably a little bit more at times, because we were finishing races a minute in front of other people, which was slightly embarrassing at times. In fact, Monza that year, we lapped everybody. By the end of the first lap, because of general mistakes, bad decisions, I think we were, Michael and Rubens were last and penultimate, and they finished the race first and second, almost lapping Fernando Alonso in third. So
that is bonkers, isn't it? Is that inevitable in our sport, that it's cyclical, a team will just hit a purple patch? And because at the moment there's lots of, it's just so boring, but hasn't that always been the case, that now with Mercedes, before that with Red Bull, and then with you at Ferrari, that it's just the way sport works, or at least Formula One?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. And I think what we don't do enough, I was reading about the Premiership. I'm slightly obsessed with football, and I was reading about, what Man City have done this year, which is incredible, to be honest. And when you read about it, it's kind of, everything's written, and everything, the whole narrative there is a celebration of excellence. And what we don't do in Formula One, I don't think, is we don't celebrate the excellence. We're about the pinnacle of motorsport. We're about being excellent. We're about achieving, the ultimate goals. And when you get a team like Mercedes, and before that Red Bull, and before that Ferrari, what we're not doing, we celebrate for a short while, because they're kind of, they've knocked whoever was the previous king off their throne. So we celebrate that for a short while, but very quickly we get bored of it. And what we don't do
almost
is
almost resent it a bit.
And totally resent it, because it's ruining the sport and all the rest of it. But it's not their fault, and it's like Lewis Hamilton. Lewis came out with, after the French Grand Prix, that, don't blame us kind of thing. We don't make the rules. And he's dead right. It's not the drivers, it's not the team's fault. As a whole, Formula One, the teams, the drivers, the commercial rights holder, the governing body, we all have a responsibility to put on a show and to make it entertaining. But if the formula is such that it allows for somebody to dominate, then let's celebrate that. Let's celebrate their success and how good they are and what they're doing as a team. You look at Mercedes now, and they are, for want of a better word, and I'll get killed in all courts for saying this, but they're dominant. Of course they are. But they've worked their asses off to get into that position. And I've been in a position where I've been part of a team that's worked its ass off to get into a position of utter dominance, where you're winning everything, and you kind of get slated, and you think, well, that can't be right, because, where do you win? Have you got, this period of, 6 months where you are winning, initially winning, and that's all right, and before that you're rubbish because you're not winning, and then after you're winning too much?
Do you think it's a British thing. I mean, because when I'm thinking about those who are making the complaints, it does seem to be from these quarters. And I am always surprised that Lewis Hamilton doesn't get more praise. You know, this is a five-time world champion that has done incredibly well. His story should be a movie. I'm sure it will be. But I just think we love a plucky underdog. And then beyond that, the minute people start just getting a bit too successful, I want to bring them back down to earth.
Yeah, it's definitely, I think...
Why do we do it?
I don't know. It's part of our culture, isn't it? I've got no idea why we don't just celebrate, you know, somebody who is dominant and brilliant. Mm. You know, we always want the... I think it's a natural part of the culture that you want an underdog to do well. Of course you do. But then that shouldn't be so imbalanced that you can't also celebrate, you know, excellence and dominance. And Lewis is a prime example. You know, the lad's done fantastic. He's not from a particularly wealthy background. You know, I don't really know a lot about his background, but I don't think he's from a particularly wealthy background. He was picked up by McLaren when he was young. But he's done a lot of that himself, you know, and his talent is mercurial. He's absolutely brilliant in that car, and that's what Mercedes pay him for. But also, he's got that whole, you know, you've got to give a lot of credit to Toto and the team as well for the way that they've made the whole thing gel together. You know, and they just keep knocking out, you know, brilliant car after brilliant car, but he keeps delivering it as well. And I think there's you know, it's so dominated by the car now and engineers, Formula One, that there's very few drivers that you could put in a less than brilliant car and hope that they're going to win the world championship for you. In fact, you can count them on one or two, maybe three fingers. But he's one of them.
Yeah, I mean, as an engineer, what is it like working with someone like that? You know, as you say, it's... Well, I don't know, what percentage would you give it, car versus driver?
It depends on the driver. It absolutely depends on the driver. You know, it's a good question and people are always asking it, but I think it depends on the driver. I don't think you can say, you know, for this driver it's 50-50. Definitely for Lewis it's 50-50 and maybe even, you know, 60-40 in his favour. For other drivers, you know, let's say not AAA grade drivers who've got in brilliant cars and still and can still win and win world championships as well. It's perhaps, you know, 60-40, 70-30 in the car's favour. So it really depends on the driver and his talent. But Lewis is very much a triple A grade talent that we should be celebrating on a daily basis.
Would you like the opportunity to work with Lewis if you do go back into the sport? Would you like to go at the top end of the sport or come in with a lower team and bring them up through the ranks?
I've got no fixed idea, but right now, if I think about it... I think I would like to go back in, having kind of tasted both sides over the last however many years it is, of going in there and having success in something that's been built and contributing to that in some way, of course, or maybe contributing in a bigger way to a project and bringing that up. I think that I would like to go into something which has that success. If you're going to do Formula One, you know, or my attitude of, if you're going to Formula One, then you've got to get out of bed on a Sunday morning and have skin in the game. You know, you've got to get out of bed on a Sunday morning and think, right, we can win this today, and that be a realistic chance as well, not just some, you know, pie in the sky dream. So I think if when you know, I do go back into it on a full-time basis.
They said it was if/when, and I felt that the emphasis was more on when.
Really? I've just said if when, that's all I've said, Natalie. If I do go into it on a full-time basis, then I think I'd like to do it with a top team and be part of that, you know, contribute to that success.
No, I can see that. It must be demoralising when you are fighting back and hoping to clinch a point at the end. I never really get that. Oh, we're hoping to get a point today. You know, that must be, I don't know, that must be bloody hard to keep raising your game and team morale and momentum and everything else. Actually brings me on to Williams. Where do you think things started to go wrong for Williams? Because certainly when you came in, there was a bit of a back in 2014, you know, we're talking about Williams being clearly the fourth best team and perhaps breaking into the top three. So where did things go wrong?
Well, I think in 2014, they you know, Williams, we had the, on some occasions, we'd have had the second fastest car.
Yeah.
you know, overall we finished third in the championship, which makes us probably the third fastest team. The year after, we finished again third, but we probably didn't have the third fastest car that year. So that was, you know, I think we did a really good job as a racing team. It's difficult to pinpoint. There's never one thing, you know, and I don't want to give you some corporate rubbish answer. But there's never one thing. It's, you know, there's never one thing why are Mercedes so dominant and smashing it at the minute. There's not one reason for it. There's not one person. Why have Williams gone so far backwards? I guess there's never one thing, you know, and I'm not obviously going to talk about individuals because that would be wrong. But has Williams been able to keep up technically with the competition and with that whole development capability? Clearly not, you know. And I think if they were to really look inwardly at themselves and understand, you know, pit themselves against a, not even a top team, but a midfield team that has perhaps got a different way of doing Formula One, in the way that they are, you know, let's say taking R&D capability and knowledge from other teams, Williams is still trying to do it completely alone. Mm. Now, that's not to say that you can't do it completely on your own, because McLaren have shown this year that by being wholly independent, and even, you know, with a Renault engine, which I still don't think is at the level of a Mercedes or a Ferrari engine, they're still performing very, very well. However, you know, it comes down a little bit to, no, it comes down not a little bit, it comes down a lot predominantly to budget. And McLaren have a bigger budget than Williams, and therefore they have more money to develop the car. So, you know, what you've got to be doing, you know, if I was sat at Williams at the minute, you've got to look inwardly at the infrastructure, the technical infrastructure that they've got, the people that they've got and can attract. You know, the whole design process, the aerodynamic process, the R&D process. And think about, you know, where that needs to be improved. You know, just go and walk around the grid and look at your car and go and have a look at other cars purely from a quality point of view, if you like. And think, you know, does my car match, you know, even another midfield car's quality? And if not, then what do I do to improve that?
Yeah, because it does feel as if everybody else has got their act together. That midfield seems crazily competitive at the moment, and also maybe a cultural thing. I don't know that you talk about the culture at Mercedes, and certainly when we interview the drivers after the race, even though they keep on winning, somehow they jump out of bed the next morning and want to try that bit harder. There's always room for improvement.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's, we had that at Ferrari. We used to all get together, like kind of the middle and senior managers after a race, and Jean and Ross would chair like a Monday morning meeting, and it was a 9 o'clock Monday morning meeting, you know, so it wasn't as if like you kind of all rocked up at lunchtime after, you know, coming first and second. But, you know, woe betide us if we hadn't come first and second. It was kind of, you know, we definitely didn't have a dark atmosphere, but we knew that we'd left points on the table, and that wasn't kind of good enough, and must try harder. So I think you've got to kind of, that culture's got to come from the top. So it had to come from Jean and Ross in Ferrari, and it will come from Toto in Mercedes, where, you know, where nothing is ever good enough. You know, you're always aiming, and even when you are first and second, there's still stuff that you've done wrong. And I think that attitude, you have to have that attitude in Formula One. You know, you can't leave anything on the table, and you definitely can't sweep anything under the carpet as well. Everybody's got to look. What my attitude when I went to Williams and Pat Simmons and I started to kind of, you know, reshape things, especially on the racing team. You know, Jason Somerville was in the aero team and actually doing a really commendable job when you look back at the resource and the people that he had. He produced a really, you know, good slippery car. You know, and there's the other senior technical managers there as well. one of the things that we definitely kind of did there at the outset was to say, right, we're not going to sweep anything under the carpet, you know, because that by doing that, we're not learning. And it's all right. It's not about the individual mistake. I think Toto, I read something from Toto a few years back where he said it's not the, I can't remember, don't blame the person, blame the problem or something like that. And he's absolutely right. You know, it's not an individual's fault, you know, quite often. I remember my first Grand Prix my second Grand Prix actually at Williams, where I'm kind of sat in the middle of the pit wall and we did a 1 minute pit stop and I'm kind of watching this thing unfold in front of me going, oh my god, I wish I got that probation period in my contract. No, I didn't think that, but anyway, I kind of went back to the hotel and Lucy was in the hotel and I'm like, I can't swear, can I? But I kind of,
you can went, definitely swear.
Right, I went, fuck, what have I done? And she said, well, it's a challenge, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, you're going to have to try and sort it out. And the thing was, what we said then, we started to introduce, you know, a lot more process and procedure.
Yeah.
But what I said to everybody is that what I want is after every Grand Prix, as we all sit down as a group of, you know, senior and middle managers, and we discuss openly about what the problems were, you know, and that's catalogued somehow, and we were able to go back on that and look at it and say, right, well, you know, we've made a mistake and that's all right. Because it was kind of like the attitude at that point was to blame the poor mechanic who I think had come out of the garage 15 times with the wrong tyre and ran around the car. It was kind of like Morris dancing, you know what I mean? When you're watching it, you go, what the fuck is this lot doing? You've got me swearing now, so...
Potty mouth's engaged.
And I'm kind of looking at it, and the attitude was, you know, I got a lot of people coming up to me after that saying, you know, and it was very, just blame the easiest person, the lad holding the hot potato at the end who had the, and I said, but it's never that person's fault.
And actually, blame culture doesn't really help anyone, does it?
Of course it doesn't. In fact, it ruins a Formula One team. Mm. It completely ruins and stagnates and stifles a Formula One team because people just won't work. If they think they're going to put their head above the parapet, because don't forget, Formula One is a passion and a vocation, but it's also a job.
Mm.
You know, most people need it to pay their mortgages, so they're not going to put their head above the parapet and in a blame culture environment and say, yeah, actually I made that mistake, you know, I understand where that mistake originates from and it was me, because, you know, they're just going to get done for it. Whereas if you just say, right, well, let's take away the individual blame and let's just start looking at the process as to how things went wrong, you'll always get back to a process. You'll always get back to a single point where you say, right, it originates from there. And it's probably originated 3 weeks before, you know, the actual, you know, the kerfuffle, the hot potato that went on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon. So by kind of introducing that, I think that we were able to make really fast inroads on things, and people were starting to put their head above the parapet to say, this is really important. I think perhaps where we didn't, you know, accelerate forward as much as we should have done is then what we should have been doing is looking at, because that's kind of easy to put together. You just need a group of technical leaders who are going to say, right, it's our responsibility, so don't worry about that, you lot just do your jobs, and let's make sure that if we're making mistakes, we're not making them twice, and let's put process in place of how we design and develop cars, and you can do all that with good people. What you can't do is you can't do, you know, R&D, you know, research and development that needs a lot of technical infrastructure, that needs benches and rigs and stuff like that. You can't do that just in people's heads, you know. You can't build that. It's not stuff that you can change from, you know, 360 degrees or 180 degrees, overnight, like you can with how you manage people. And I think, you know, if Williams are going to improve, then they're going to have to somehow either take that R&D infrastructure and that knowledge from elsewhere, as other people have done, which I know Claire is vehemently against, or you're going to have to build it yourself. But you can't live without it. You can't just say, well, it's a black hole in our organisation and we don't have that. You know, Mercedes and Ferrari and Red Bull, they all do it themselves, and these other midfield teams, they're kind of getting it done by other people, but we're not going to do it. That just doesn't work. It just means that you're losing lap time and performance over them people.
You talked a bit earlier about driver versus car, and I want to know how much of an impact an engineer makes. So let's talk a bit more about the brain inside that head of yours and how it works and how you perhaps divide up the jobs, delegate, how much responsibility you take yourself. Just talking about, you know, ownership of roles and responsibility. How much of a difference can an engineer like you make?
Well, me individually, I'm not sure, but let's talk in general. I think, you know, in terms of, well, if you run a department, then in terms of responsibility, actual where the buck stops, it's got to stop with you. And you can't allow it to stop anywhere else. You know, you can't. And I learned that. If I learned that off any one individual, it was from Jean Todd, who actually, you know, I said earlier, he looked after me when I went to Ferrari, and he was always very good to me and kind of guiding me as to, you know, how to behave, how to manage. And then Stefano to a large extent as well after that, Stefano Domenicali. You know, they're both kind of they were both acted as mentors to me. You know, although there's much less age difference between me and Stefano than there is between me and John. He'll probably kill me for saying that. He just looks at me in a very evil way. He does that with everyone. He doesn't listen to this, does he?
Never know.
Anyway, you know, I kind of, you know, got a lot of guidance off them, yeah. in terms of, you know, how to manage people and all the rest of it. One thing that I got off Jean 100% was, it's your responsibility. You know, at that point in my career, it was a car, and it was managing, say, 10, 20 people. And then, you know, latterly, it was managing, you know, departments of people. And again, it was that the responsibilities got to lie with me. You've got to, as a manager, you've got to have vision. You've got to be able to put that vision into some kind of strategy, you know, a short, medium, long-term strategy. But you've also got to be able to delegate. You've got to have people around you that you trust. You've got to have people around you that you think, you know, are both technically able and or able to manage groups. And they're the people, you know, once you've got this long-term vision and strategy, which has to come predominantly from yourself, then you've got to let them people do the jobs. And
I guess that's the hard bit, isn't it? Because if it's the old adage that if you think you can do it better yourself, you won't let anyone else go anywhere near it.
Yeah, you will, but that'll kill you, to be honest. That'll kill you very, very quickly. You know, if you think you're better than everybody at everything, you're wrong, basically. Doesn't matter who you are, you're wrong. So you've got to pick the things that you are good at. And we're all good at some things and we're all bad at some things. You know, I know the areas where I'm particularly weak.
Which are? Hard to think of them now, isn't it?
No, it's really, really hard to think of them. I like to have a, you know, especially when it comes to technical problems, I like to have a really, any problems really, I like to have a, you know, I like to set vision and set strategy and understand what we're going to do technically, and be involved in that, you know, in setting that technical path. But then I'm actually quite bad at concentrating. I think, you know, I can be, my mind's always like thinking about the next thing. I want to think about the next thing and how we're going to get performance on the car and how we're going to do that. And kind of once you've set that path and you've got down to a certain level of technical detail, I'm much happier, like, just for somebody else to do that. You know, if you're staying in there, you know, to the very bitter end of the technical detail thread, then you're missing the bigger picture, yeah, kind of thing.
Yeah. But in a way, are we expecting too much of engineers? Because from experience, quite a lot of people in Formula One seem to be on the spectrum. So they don't, therefore, necessarily have the social skills to manage people. This is something of a generalisation, but there's got to be something in this that we are expecting a lot from one individual, even with the ability to divide up tasks, delegate and all the rest of it. We are expecting a lot, aren't we?
Yeah, but I don't know whether the teams are really structured like that anymore, you know, that there's any one single individual who you know, designs, develops, runs the car. I don't know.
You are expected to be people managers as well as being technically savvy and make, you know, decisions for the future development of the car.
Yeah, but that's why you've got to be able to delegate as well. And I think that comes, it's not natural for all of us engineers, but I think you must be able to delegate. You must be able to have people around you that you trust who are usually, you know, I always surround myself with you know, people who follow me around are usually technically very, very good. They're not particularly people managers. You know, you might not take them to you might not take them to Soho House for to have a nice lunch now, but because they'd probably end up kicking the doors in.
Is that what I expect from you later then?
Yes.
Great.
Smash the place up. But I think that you need that level of technical people that you can kind of say, right, this is the vision and these are the boundaries in which I want you to work and develop something. Go and do it. Mm. And then you also need, you know, probably the level above that is good people managers. You know, they've got to be technically savvy, but you need good people managers. And people like me, the job is to kind of to manage that whole culture between the two. You know, it's still about setting vision, and it's still about, I think you can't be a senior technical leader in Formula One if you don't have a really good knowledge of the overall car performance, you know, and the bits that were missing. You know, if you've got bits missing in your armory where you don't really know, you know, we're all, let's say, we all have a deep knowledge in some area, but you've got to also understand the other areas as well. Yeah. So obviously I'm not an aerodynamicist, but I took it upon myself at quite an early age to go and understand the aerodynamics of a car, that you can have conversations that just aren't one question deep, you know, and be able to challenge as well and say, well, why have we done that? You know, why have we taken that philosophy with the car? And understand what, you know, also what other people have done on the car. Then, you know, tyres was something that I, you know, became quite obsessed about, because it's kind of something that it's a real performance differentiator as well. And you hear it all the time, and it's always, you know, you hear our problem is tyres, or their problem is tyres, or whatever. Well, what does that mean? You know, go into it and understand it. And actually, it's something that as I said, I've particularly taken myself to task on and try to understand it over the past 5-10 years. But you've got to understand the whole area, because if you can't understand the whole complexity, the technical complexity of a Formula One car at some level, you know, and it's got to be more than one question deep, as I said, then you can't really manage the whole thing, you know. And you, because if somebody comes to you, if a tyre expert comes to you and says, I would like to do this, and an aerodynamicist expert comes to you and say, I would like to do this, and the two things are incongruent, there's a big word for you, then you've got to know where the compromise lies between them. You know, you've got to be able to arbitrate that compromise and say, well, actually, what we'll do is we'll do 60% of your thing and 40% of your thing, and we'll end up with the best compromise. So I don't think that you can technically manage people or departments if you don't have that level of knowledge.
And how important is your relationship with your driver? Because I heard you say once you almost became too close to Felipe, and when he had his accident in 2009, it was very tough for you, and you said, well, actually, I don't want to get that close to a driver again. But how important is it to have that synergy and that strong dynamic in order to deliver performance?
I think it's important to have a really strong relationship with all of your, with all team members, first of all. You know, it doesn't have to be sat in, you don't want to be sat in an ivory tower. But definitely the drivers play a key role. And I think that I've always had with all of the drivers that I've ever worked with, I've always had a good relationship, you know, whether that's from a, you know, running a department point of view, or a race engineer, or a data engineer before that, a performance engineer. I think I've always had a strong relationship with the drivers, because they are at some times probably the most fragile link. They can be the strongest link in the chain. They can be the most fragile link in the chain at times, and you've got to understand that actually, you know, as much as we as engineers, you know, we get a little bit of the limelight and let's say, you know, the responsibility for the car performance, it's them who go out on a Sunday afternoon, on a Saturday and Sunday afternoon. It's very easy that, you know, you'll very rarely, you know, look on, I haven't got social media, but you'll very rarely look on social media or the media in general, and you'll see, you know, individual engineers getting slated. But you will very, very often see individual drivers getting slated, and they're human beings, you know. As you know, from the mentally strongest of them, you know, like Fernando Alonso, to the less strong of them, they all have their foibles and they all need an arm around them. And sometimes, you know, it's just about doing that, or it's also about, you know, trying to understand their technical language as well. That's the other reason why you've got to, you know, have a good relationship with the drivers, because they don't speak the language of engineers. They have, you know, most of them are, you know, quite technically strong, but they speak a different language.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
You've got to understand that language.
Well, it's more about feel for them than it's about actual knowledge of the technicality.
Yeah, they do. They feel, you know, all of them, they drive the car through their arse, you know. They feel it through their fingertips, and they feel it through the seat of their overalls. And you've then got to have some kind of, you know, it's like the Tower of Babel sometimes, where they're saying, you know, I often listen, especially with younger, you know, race engineers or whatever, is that they're saying something, and, you know, the race engineer will be having a completely different conversation with them, and you kind of have to get in there as a translator and say, well, actually, what he's actually saying is this, you know, and kind of put that translation together. Others are very good at technically explaining stuff, but as I say, they do speak a different language, but they do it from feeling. You know, they don't understand things at the depth of what engineers do, and nor should they, you know, because neither you could put an engineer in a car and get him to drive it at the speeds that the drivers do. So you've got to have that marriage between the two.
It's interesting what you say about the vulnerability of drivers, both in terms of social media criticism, they are exposed, but also physically on the track. And as you saw from Felipe's accident, you know, he's the one that took the hit, you know, literally, and risked his life to that extent. And I think that must be hard in a way for you, because you're something of a puppeteer, you're pulling the strings, but once they're out in the cockpit, they're kind of alone to that extent, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, and that's why I think they rely so much on their race engineers. You know, they become their lifeline, if you like, that you have got some link back to planet Earth while they're driving these machines. But I think that's why you've got to have that strong bond between the race engineer and the driver. It can't just be a professional thing where, you know, it's all kind of robotic and very professional and very clean. You've got to be able to have somewhat of a personal relationship, because when they're driving the cars at these very high speeds and they get themselves into a panic, or otherwise they just, you know, they just want some link back to planet Earth, back to the pit wall, then they need somebody. They need somebody human that they can rely on.
And that link brings me on nicely to your radio messages, which have become ringtones through the years. I mean, I think it's probably because, well, I don't know. Listen, I'm not singling anyone out, but at the moment, when you hear an engineer over the radio and they've just won a race, you kind of want them to go, yes, come on, you bastard. And sometimes they go, very well driven, congratulations. And you go, come on, where's the emotion, where's the energy? And we definitely saw a bit of emotion, a bit of personality in your radio messages, which kind of makes you stand out. Obviously, the most infamous one being in 2010. Do you have any regrets about the Fernando is faster than you moment in your career?
Yeah, of course I do, you know.
Like, what would you have done differently? What could you have done differently?
I think I probably, you know, if I look back on it, I think as a team, when what was that? It was like a pinball machine or something.
Oh, my God. Honestly, this was the quietest area in the whole restaurant when we arrived at 9 o'clock this morning, and now it's the loudest, so apologies for this. What I would say was ambient noise. It's not. It's just dominating. Anyway, back to 2010.
I think as a team, when we all look back, we probably could have done things differently. That's clear. But, you know, regardless of that, I think that what could I have done differently? I think you grow up, you know, and when I look back now, I can't even remember. What was it, 2010? It was 10 years ago, wasn't it? So I was like mid-30s, something like that. Definitely old enough to kind of know better. But whether or not you always behave like that in the moment is another question. I think that, you know, you kind of get yourself in a situation and feel aggrieved at things. And I definitely felt aggrieved that day that kind of, well, we've done the hard work and we're winning the race, you know, and you know, Fernando, if he is quicker, then he can pass us. So, you know, in that moment, you kind of get wrapped up in those thoughts. I think, you know, if I look back now, it was probably... I've never had a problem with team orders, by the way. I think team orders are part and parcel of the sport. They always have been, and they always will be. You got to deploy them at the right time. You can't just deploy them willy-nilly, but they've got to be done at the right time. And they kind of got to be done inclusively as well. You know, if you do them on an exclusive point of view where, you know, there's an inner circle that know about the team orders but then nobody else does, I think that can create friction. So I think if you kind of, you're all sitting down and you're being honest with each other, you know, pre-season and pre-event, and you're saying, look, if this is the situation in this race, then we will deploy team orders, I think most rational people wouldn't have a problem with that.
Whose decision was that then in 2010? Was it yours, or was it a group decision?
What, to deploy team orders? I mean, it's kind of, I guess it's a group decision in the end, but in the end, you know, Stefano would have made the ultimate decision that he wanted to deploy team orders.
So you have regret that you didn't stand up for that, against that decision? What is your regret?
No, the regret is that probably that you know, I made it quite obvious that we were deploying team orders.
Well, you should have been more subtle.
I should have been more subtle.
Okay, so we're going to role play now. How can you be more subtle? I am Felipe. You are talking to me through team radio. Go.
God, I don't know, to be
Come
honest.
Come on, you've played this out in your head. You must have done.
No, I haven't.
You must have thought, I could have done that more discreetly.
Well, for example, after he got past, I said to him something like, oh, good lad, good on you, mate, for letting him past, or something like that. Now just stick with him, or something like that. And I shouldn't have said that. You know, there's just, it's fairly subtle, to be honest, the changes that you would have made. But I should have... We all could have done better that day.
Right. Well swerved. No, but do you say that you shouldn't have said that to him afterwards because it was rubbing salt in the wound, that you were just pissing him off by saying that? Or you were accentuating, highlighting the fact that you had deployed team orders?
The latter.
Uh-huh, right, okay. And your regret was therefore that you got a big chunky 100 grand fine?
The regret was that. The regret was that, you know, in the end, I wished, you know, if I could go back in time, I want it to play out. I'd want it to play out that we all kind of sat down pre-race and we said, right, this is what we're going to do. And Rob, you're going to have to do this at some point in the race, and Felipe, you're going to have to pull over if this is the situation.
Have a code that no one else can decipher.
Yeah, and it just kind of takes the sting out of it, the emotion out of it. But then, you know, the way that it then played out, you know, Felipe wasn't playing ball, was he? I think I told him 7 times or something like that. Bless him. And, you know, in the end, you know, poor Stefano was absolutely pulling his hair out, because what should have been just an easy, you know, me telling him once and him pulling over, didn't happen.
Yeah, but I mean, you can sit there before the race and agree something in principle, but in the heat of the race and drivers being drivers, they're not necessarily going to be compliant.
No, I think if you have conversations, I think if you have adult conversations pre-race, pre-season, you know, we always try and do it pre-season now as well, and set out rules of engagement. I think if you do that, then it takes the emotion out of it so much more. Okay. I think if you're, and people are allowed to voice their opinion as well. If we say, right, you know, driver A is our number one driver, regardless of what it says in contracts, driver A is our number one driver, and driver B is, you are our number two driver. And, you know, it's not so much about number one or number two, but we will back driver A in the situation where there's a 50-50. You know, I think Ferrari have done, you know, for all Ferrari get slated, I think, you know, what Mattia did at the start of the season by saying, right, well, we're going to back Sebastian when there's a 50-50 situation, I think that's absolutely fair enough.
And Charles will take that, given that he's new to the role and he's learning, and this, you know, you'd rather be driving for Ferrari than at the back of the grid.
Of course you would. Yeah. Of course you would, and Charles will definitely take that. But I think you're dead right in kind of setting that out, and what you do is you take all the emotion out of it. It's not just something that appears on a Sunday afternoon and people go, well, where did that come from? You know, there was a narrative leading up to that.
So, if that in mind, who was more pissed off, Stefano with Felipe or Felipe with Stefano? And where did you fit into all of that?
I think that Felipe was extremely pissed off. Yeah, he was livid. I mean, it was kind of like, you know, it kind of ruined him for a while. For a long while, I would say.
What, in terms of his racing, in terms of his relationship with the team,
in both terms, I think. I think that's quite. He found it a little bit difficult to come to terms with that one, and obviously, you know, Stefano is he's a really good friend of mine, and as I said earlier, he kind of mentored me through a lot of my time at Ferrari, and I've only got good things to say about him, you know, both as a man and as a manager. He was extremely pissed off with the situation, because what should have been just an easy, you know, right, this is the situation, this is what's going to happen now, people, and you're all going to comply with it because I'm the boss, whether or not you're Felipe, Fernando or Rob or whoever, that didn't happen, and it turned into a kerfuffle.
Diplomatic way of putting it, yeah. Okay, good. So, like, yeah, as you say, you grew up at 40, so you've got all this wealth of experience, because everything has come to you pretty young, you have to say, that even now in your mid-40s, it's like you've had a whole lifetime in the sport to learn and glean from and become the best consultant you can be.
I guess so. Yeah, it did all... I guess I was just, you know... I don't really know how it all happened. I think a lot of it, you know, a lot of it, if you have to be honest with yourself as well, a lot of it is luck as well. You're in the right place at the right time. You've then got to work hard when you're given the opportunities, and make sure that you make good on those opportunities. But you know, nobody should be looking back on their career and saying, wow, look how good I am, look how good I was and what I achieved. You know, a lot of what we're given is we're just in the right place at the right time. But yeah, you're right. I have. I did do everything. I've always been like that. I've always been like on fast forward, 100 mile an hour, in everything, even in life, and definitely in Formula One, things happen quite early for me. So I can kind of, you know, I've been in Formula One now for 20 years, and you know, longer in fact. And I kind of got to the point now where you need a little bit of reflection. You know, 20 years of doing that, of going around the world with a circus, you know, I can carry on, I can do it for 30 years, I can do it for 40 years. But it's now time to reflect and become, as you say, the best consultant that I can be.
Yeah, but a sabbatical is quite a healthy thing, isn't it? Just to take stock and work out. And hopefully for everybody in Formula One, that means coming back to the sport full-time, competitive way. But, you know... It is important to have quality time. I think, actually, a lot of people say the older your kids get, the more they need you, which I don't know, that fills me with a bit of dread, because right now I feel like I need them and they need me. But if it's going to get even more so, then I've got to do less races, not more. So how do you deal with that? Like, how does Lucy feel about the fact that you may go back to the sport full time?
She's just always been really, really supportive.
When you're at the house.
Yeah, I'm getting under her feet now. Fuck off. Go on, get out. She's just always been really supportive. I mean, and I can't, you know, say enough about her, to be honest. She's just this brilliant, intelligent, wonderful human being. Sound like you're going to vom now, aren't you?
Oh, it's lovely.
And she's supported me, you know, throughout my career, in my life, really, you know, because I don't know whether I'm the easiest person to live with as well.
Why not?
Well, we all have our foibles, don't we? We're all just a bit mad when we're at home, or just in general. I think I'm a person who can't, you know. We're just, you know, our life, our kind of our private life, social life is non-stop. It's full on. And that's because I'm a person who's all right, what we do next? What we do next? Right, I'm bored now. What we do next? You know, and she's like, sometimes, oh, for fuck's sake, just slow down and like stop for a bit. But I quite like it like that. I think it's good for kind of, you know, your mental state. That, you know, we all have our different ways of kind of keeping ourselves motivated and you know looking to the next thing. And that's mine. You know, I've always been, you know, really, really busy and just, you know, either privately or at work. So even in what is supposed to be a year of sabbatical, it's great actually, because we're doing lots of holidays, but I'm also really busy with work and really busy with kind of stuff that is like in the middle of work and private.
One of the things that you do together, which I think is really healthy to have kind of passion projects as a couple, is your charity work, the philanthropic endeavours that perhaps a lot of the listeners don't know about. Just tell us the background to that.
Well, I mean, how it all started actually was in 2007, our daughter Minnie was stillborn. So actually it was on the day that we were going into hospital for her to be delivered, because she was overdue. She was stillborn, and obviously that hit us incredibly hard, you know. I mean, it still does as a parent, you know. I think about her every day, and she's become part of our lives, you know. She is just part of, you know, Frankie and Felix, who are my two boys. It's their big sister. And you know, so we spent a period of, you know, grieving and mourning, you know, a long period, in fact. And in fact, what I should do at this juncture is I've got to mention Ferrari in that, because they were just outstanding. I couldn't have worked for a better, you know, employer. I couldn't have worked for a better team. They were, and it was, I think it's the whole Italian thing. They were so human about it, and they just said to me, "Take your time, do what you want, and when you want to come back, you'll come back, and if you don't want to come back, you won't." And there was some individuals there, principally Stefano, where I kind of formed a bond with him like a brother, you know, like an older brother, because he just looked after both me and Lucy in such a deep human way that you can't forget things like that. You can never ever forget that milk of human kindness. And there was other people there as well, you know, all of those people who are household names who really like looked after me and Lucy at the time. And then after that period, it was very soon after that we just said, you know, we're in this incredibly fortunate position, you know. We're both from fairly, I don't want to sound like a working class hero, but we're both from, like, you know, very normal backgrounds. We've been given all these incredible opportunities in life, but now kind of, you know, and it's all just been on the ascent. And now you've got one of life's harsh realities slap you in the face, you know, something that is going to define you in a lot of ways, you know, define us individual, define us as a couple. And you think, wow, you know, what can we do to help other people in that situation? So we started to put together these charity events, and, you know, the first people that we got involved with was SANS, which is Stillborn and Neonatal Death Society, and so we put together a gala dinner for them, and then it kind of just went on and become a little bit more general, Just, you know, being patrons of charities, doing things. You know, I can, you know, Lucy does all the hard work. I kind of turn up and talk to people and say a few daft things, and they all come and pay money, and then we'll do an auction. And all the teams are always very generous, and the wider community is always very generous as well, you know, with giving fantastic, you know, money can't buy prizes, that type of thing, and experiences, and we always make a load of money. And I think if you're in such a fortunate position that you can do that, why not do it? Mm. Why not do it and give back to society?
Yeah, I mean, clearly helping others, but how does that work help you process the grief? Because it's unimaginable what you guys went through, and presumably just applying yourselves in that way was part of the bereavement process.
Massively. It made us feel, I mean, it makes you feel good about yourself to a certain extent, and it makes the loss of, you know, it made the loss of Minnie kind of easier to deal with, and give her a purpose as well. It was about her, you know, and a lot of what we'd still do with charities, you know, especially the charities for, you know, either poorly children or stillborn children, is all about her. You know, in my mind, it's still about her, and it still gives her a purpose and still makes her live on, you know. And she does, you know what I mean? It was she was born on the 4th of June. So we had a birthday party a couple of weeks back or whenever it was. We still go and let balloons out, and then my mum and my sister who live up north, you know, they do the same thing as well. We like let some balloons off, and we write, like, the boys write messages on them and stuff like that, and they love it actually, because they get cake and toys and stuff like that. It's a proper birthday party. But you know, the whole charity thing, it just gives, it still keeps her alive, if you like, and gives us a purpose, you know, and her a purpose. So it's just nice.
So if people want to support the work that you're doing, that they can Google Sands, or what else could they do?
Well, so the things that the other charity that I'm involved is for mesothelioma, because I lost my dad a couple of years ago to mesothelioma, which is a really, nobody knows what it is, but it's actually what we used to call asbestosis. So it's when you breathe in asbestos and it goes onto your lung and then forms a cancer. So there's that charity as well. So there's Sands, there's Zoe's Place, which is a palliative care for very, very poorly sick children, and they're around the country. And then there's Mesothelioma UK. So I'm actually doing an event for Mesothelioma UK next week, in fact. So down at Limpston Manor for, you know, Michael Caine. I'm going to sound like, you know, sound like Smash United and my great mate Michael Caine's the celebrity chef. So Michael, who's a pal of mine, has invited me along he does like a little mini car fest at Limpston Manor. So just, you know, get involved. If you want to get involved with that, then get involved with Limpston Manor. Go down and see it. Support the charities. You know, there's spinal injuries charity as well, which Michael is, we're doing kind of 50-50 between the two. Just get involved and make donations. And the next time that Lucy and I are doing an event, get involved with that as well.
Yeah, good stuff. Listen, you got your hands full. You're certainly busy. I know that you're not at the racetracks that much, but you're busy, aren't you?
Yeah, I am actually. I'm really busy. To be honest with you, I'm much busier than I expected to be with the Formula One stuff. You know, Ross kind of, it wasn't public knowledge that I was going to take a sabbatical, but Ross kind of got to hear about it through WifeNet, because Lucy's good friends with Jean, his wife. So he approached me like in early part, middle of last year, and said, "Oh, do you want to come along and like help us out? And get you out of the house a couple of days a week." So I was like,
Lucy had tipped him, Gene off, yeah, to tip, yeah, Ross off to get you out of the house. I love it.
So I said yes, and actually I'm really quite enjoying it, and that's something that I've got to think more seriously about, I think, because when I think about it, you know, I've done Formula One for 20 years in a very similar sphere, let's say, And is it now time to kind of make, to help make Formula One better, you know, which I can do from within, you know, by helping Ross out?
And just as I was wrapping the podcast up, you go and tease us with that. Come on then, how are you going to do it?
Well, you know, what I'm doing now is I'm, you know, what he's tasked me with is to try to bring some of that technical insight, that team's insight, to the general fan base. You know, and you've got to do that on all different levels, because obviously you've got your uber geek fan base who you know, who are avid watchers, and they're you know, they're quasi engineers kind of thing. And then you've got you know, mum at home who kind of watches it, you know, because in some way, shape or form, because it's on the telly, linear TV, so I'm learning all the phrases now. And then you've got all the digital platforms as well, which is what all the I generation, it's another phrase, are watching it. So it's kind of bringing, you know, the technical insights and the way that we go about it as teams to the general public. And is there more of that that I can do? I don't know. You know, there's stuff that's open. I'm going to start my own go-kart team.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think what my role in that could be. Probably not racing in it. Maybe I could be like catering. No, you definitely. I'm terrible making tea. Can I have some kind of role in it?
What, in my go-kart team?
Yeah.
You can just be. You can just be my mate. What about that?
Okay, good. Okay, nice one.
The money won't be very good.
Oh, that's all right. We wouldn't expect anything less. Tight northern bastard. Listen, you've imparted some of that technical knowledge today, so for that I'm very grateful, and I'm sure everyone listening, even the people in the kitchen behind us who have been lapping all this up.
On the pinball machine.
Yeah, they've been busy cooking your lunch. Rob, thank you so much for your time. I do appreciate it. And we wait with bated breath as to your next move.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, good.
I do enjoy these things.
Thank you very much.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.